worth mentioning again, the Gallagher's faceoff totals way up this year. He won it. Here's Patrick, a shot by Radulov. He scores! Radulov got it from Weber. Gallagher was in front, and he scored the goal. Radulov back to Weber, backing up, shoots it off a stick. They score! Weber put it off a flyer stick and passed Mason, and it's 1-0 Montreal. Here's a flip pass, Radulov, open net, and he scores! And he deserves an empty net goal. He's worked so hard tonight, the Canadiens are up 3-1.
La deuxième étoile, the second star, Shea Weber! Et la première étoile, the first star, Alexander Radulov.
You know, maybe the one interesting projection is Radulov, who I've got down for 58 points. His is a complicated situation. You know, we have a bit of an NHL track record for him, although none of it terribly recent. And he's been massively productive in the KHL, and usually players coming from the KHL tend to have a pretty strong translation factor if you're equating their points to NHL points.
Feel like a stranger in this land. I feel like a number. I'm not a number. I'm not a number. Damn it, I'm a man. I said I'm a man.
Welcome back. It's hour number two. It's game night. The Canadiens and Islanders in Brooklyn tonight. We'll take you there. It's an early start, 7 o'clock. So is World Series Game 2, moved up by an hour because of threatening weather in Cleveland. Along with Rod Francis and Mitch Gallo, Mitch Melnick with you until 7 o'clock. Bill Lee, you may have seen him locally on WPTZ out of Burlington on television last night. Full hour debate to become the next governor of the state of Vermont. Bill will join us as per usual in about 20 minutes. Pierre Maguire at MSG after 5. Rich Griffin is at the World Series. He'll also join us before 6. Gordon Miller will be dropping in as well, and the Expos Fantasy Cam contest will continue. That last voice you heard was the last time we chatted with one of our favorite conversations whenever he joins the show from TSN. He is their main analytics guy, Mr. Scott Cullen. How you doing?
I'm great. How you doing, Mitch?
I'm fine, thank you. So, right, you know, my math, I'm not very good at math, but I know how many games they've played, and I know that Radulov, how many points he has, so he is, like, shattering your projection of 58 points here. By the way, we were all in the same ballpark when it came to Radulov. We all thought 50 to 55 around there. You had him at 58. And for those who may not have been around, very briefly, Scott, before you joined us, how you arrived at that figure?
There's a thing that's kind of gone around in analytics recently called NHL equivalency, and you look at where players have played the year before they come to the NHL, and you know, you take all these players and you see what happens when they move on to the next league, and in a lot of cases, you know, the translation on points per game drops dramatically. You know, if you've got a kid coming out of junior to go into the NHL, you're dropping their points per game in most cases to, like, you know, 30%. Of what they were doing in junior. Now, Radulov coming from the KHL, the translation was stronger, and I think it was somewhere around 80%. But you're also dealing with a pretty small sample of guys who come from the KHL to play in the NHL. It's not the same as what you get in some other leagues. And Radulov's also a different case. You know, you're getting a guy who's now 30 years old. A lot of times when you're getting a guy to come over from the KHL, it's, you know, he's a young guy who's just played a year or two over there, or it's Jaromir Jagr. And so you're... you know, you don't have a perfect match for what you get out of Alexander Radulov, but, you know, as opposed to using nothing, we use NHL equivalency to at least get a baseline and then kind of, you know, see whether that seems reasonable for his situation in Montreal. And I think, you know, what we've seen so far is his usage is probably as expected in terms of playing time and, you know, his role on the team as a top six forward. I think, you know, he's probably used a little bit more defensively than might have been anticipated. But all in all, I think, you know, Radulov's transition to the NHL has been pretty smooth.
You mentioned his age, and I'm curious, because I know that's something all you guys track, and it's important, is when a guy, generally speaking, when a guy starts to decline, and how different a rate of decline is that for star caliber players, if in fact it is different?
Well, the latest we've come up with when you're talking about kind of the very best years of players is generally from 24 to 26, and compared to, say, what it seemed like when I was growing up, everybody would talk about, well, 28 to 32 are kind of the peak years, and we basically found out that it's earlier than that. And when it comes to guys who are star players, yeah, they decline, but the decline in many cases is fairly gradual for them. And so you can get people who kind of get their back up when you say things like, well, he's in decline, because the guy's still really good. Like, people will point to Jerome Iginla, who scored 30 goals until he was like 38 years old. You say, well, yes, but at his peak, he was scoring 50 and 55. So just because, you say somebody's in decline doesn't mean they aren't a good and very useful player. But all these things are relative, and the same goes for in the off season when people were talking about Steven Stamkos. It's tough to say that, well, at 26, Steven Stamkos is in decline. Well, his decline might be that he's not going to score 60 goals again. He still might, but the odds are that you're not going to hit that kind of that high water mark that he has already hit.
Right.
And so it might just mean, guys, particularly the guys who are at the really high end, well, the decline kind of, is real gradual, and you could still be a very productive player into your mid-30s when you're, an elite talented player.
From Scott Cullen, TSN, TSN.ca, Melnick in the afternoon on TSN 690, along with Rod Francis and Mitch Gallo. Habs and Islanders tonight at 7 right here.
Hey, Scott. Needless to say, a lot of analytic hires by NHL teams have been publicized, and that's terrific news. I'm wondering if you know of some teams that have preferred to go and stay under the radar when embracing, at least to some degree, analytics.
Well, I think there are a few teams that have... that don't get very kind of public about what they're doing. I mean, and one that kind of jumps out to me is the Chicago Blackhawks. And Mark Lazarus is one of their beat reporters, and he wrote a piece a few years back, explaining all the things that the Blackhawks are interested in, they look at, and so on. But when they talk to Stan Bowman about it, he's kind of like, well, yeah, we believe in it and we're happy with it, but, he's not trying to convince anybody, He's happy with what he gets, and so there isn't, I can kind of go through a bunch of the teams in the league and say, well, okay, I know who's doing analytics for this team, I know who's doing analytics for that team. I don't really know who's doing it for Chicago, but at the same time, I'm aware that they at least have some process that they're using, and they use it to value their players and then also to provide instruction to their players, because I guess one of the kind of features of it was that when you identify the things that you want to teach your players, then it gives you something to throw on the player's iPad, so that they can watch film and figure out how to get better.
Do you think there are players, I think Patrick Waugh threw this out, I think he was serious actually when he said it, that because of the Corsi specifically, that guys are shooting more often so their Corsi improves?
Well, and I know I heard that too. I don't think there's any evidence that it works. the idea of, okay, you come over center ice and there's nothing else going on, so I'm firing a puck at the net. Okay, you're plus one on Corsi, but it then means you don't have any sustained pressure, like where you get more shots, and the puck then could very easily start coming back towards your end of the ice, and so. I understand the theory behind, well, guys are just trying to game the system by doing it. A, just by my eye test, I don't see it. Like I think there are times when somebody, fires a harmless shot on net, and it's mostly because they don't have anything else going on. They're 1-on-3 and they have nowhere else to go, so they just fire it at the net and hope that they get an offensive zone faceoff. That's one thing. But I don't think that it's something that guys are consistently doing, trying to game that number.
That's really funny that you mentioned that, because that was Nathan Beaulieu actually Saturday in Boston. And because I pointed, he had a rough night, and that's why they moved Yemelin up to play with Weber. And when I said, and I wrote in the blog how poorly he played, he struggled. all night. Somebody pointed out he had 4 shots on goal. He had a total of 6 shot attempts. I said, I'm watching the game. He floated a puck in from the blue line on the power play, and they got a faceoff out of it. That happened twice. He didn't play well.
Yeah, and this is, you know, in one case, this is why you don't look at those. I look at those numbers game after game, but you also don't put a ton of value on on those numbers for a single game, because, you know, in the case of that one game, yeah, you could get a few of these harmless shots. Now, you stretch that out over the entire season, you can't imagine that Nathan Beaulieu is going to drift that many harmless shots toward the net and still keep accruing ice time and shots to make it meaningful. You know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, a coach at some point is going to intervene if you have a player who keeps drifting harmless shots towards the net and say, okay, stop it.
Well,
or we'll stop it for you.
Yeah, he was taken off the power play. And yeah. And Alexander Radulov was put on the power play, as Markov was also taken off the power, the first unit anyway. We're with Scott Cullen. So let's get to Shea Weber here, because I find it kind of fascinating and in a twisted kind of way here. I mean, the team it looks good. People who are waving the Shea Weber as a Norris candidate, which may be accurate, as if he's the best defenseman in the history of the Canadiens or since Larry Robinson, and he may be through 7 games, seem to forget the kind of start they had last year, and yep. Everything was great last year with P.K. Subban. But we had a tweet here from a regular she's changed her Twitter handle to Tickles Radulov, Chili Pepper, from Habs Eyes on the Prize. The whole Weber isn't good narrative. Why do we have to endure 82 games when teams can just submit spreadsheets in October and award the cup?
Yeah, and that's, look, the Shea Weber is the one of the poster boys for the analytics and eye test debates. And, you know, when you get, after one of Weber's games last week, I guess. I wrote that you get what you're expecting out of Shea Weber. You know, he's a beast to deal with in the physical game, and he's got a cannon of a shot, and he can score points, and he's done that so far. But he also tends to get outshot, and you know, you can kind of take that for what it's worth.
Well, let me stop you there. What is that worth? Like, how further can you break it down? If he's keeping shots to the outside, or if he's got a good stick and a play results in a shot further, you know, it's not from the slot. I mean, like, and especially if you got a goalie like Carey Price, I mean, is it really that bad?
Well, and this is the thing, and I did a piece last year on where I compared. And I'll do it again this year once we've had a few more games under our belt, is comparing the high danger chances as a percentage of the overall shot attempts, with the idea that can indicate, okay, well, who's keeping shots to the outside, at least not giving up the most dangerous opportunities relative to their overall. And it's not to say that, you know, that means more than Corsi, but it might provide some context for Corsi, right? Is that, okay, if Shea Weber is getting outshot, and, you know, that's sort of been the trend over the last few years, so, okay, if we know that that's the case, is it maybe not that bad because Shea Weber tends to keep things away? Well, last year when I did this piece, Shea Weber and Roman Josi were, like, two of the best at it. And not just for last year, it was, like, for several years.
In terms of keeping shots from the outside.
In keeping, you know, as a percentage of the overall shot attempts against them,
right.
They had far fewer that were high danger. And, you know, that's, if you go back to the now defunct site War on Ice, but other advanced stat sites use it, where they're basically looking at shots that come kind of in the home plate area or that come in transition. And, you know, it's not like you have one person tracking every one of these. This is, you know, all stuff that you're scraping out of the NHL data. But anyway, Weber has fared pretty well in that regard. So you can look at that and say, well, okay, that is positive that, you know, if you're going to be outshot, the best way to do it is to at least make sure that the shots aren't all in tight. And so that's kind of my conclusion of it is, it's sort of a mitigating factor. You know, yes, you would rather that you're doing the outshooting, but if you're going to get outshot, you know, lowering the quality of the shots against is preferable.
There's no serious player in the analytics community, Scott, is there, who thinks that Shea Weber is not a really good defenseman?
No, I don't think so. Like, and I mean, to this is all in degrees, right? Like, I think you have a lot of people who think, okay, he's not a Norris Trophy defenseman. You know, the guys who, because of the getting out shot part, like, it's one thing that he plays the tough minutes and faces the other team's top guys, but you have a bunch of defensemen who play the other team's top guys and consistently, you know, win the shot battle night after night too. And so, you know, that is sort of where people are probably like, okay, so knock Shea Weber off that tier. But I think you have a lot of people who think, yeah, Shea Weber's a bona fide number one defenseman, and then, you know, the range goes to how far down the list you think he belongs. And that usually tends to be, you know, how much weight are you putting just on the shots? And, you know, I've sort of been of the mind in recent years that, you know, I tend to like Shea Weber more than, you know, the analytics community at large, but I understand what their, you know, what the point of view is, that, you know, this is a concern if you're getting outshot night after night.
Go ahead, Mitch Gallo.
And Scott, you mentioned Weber's physical presence, and I'm wondering where we're at in terms of how analytics view a body check. So it's very simple to say, okay, if you're hitting a lot, you don't have the puck. And that makes sense, but I think it's an oversimplification. I understand also that, you know, the Canadiens were playing the Coyotes the other night, and Shea Weber went to hit a Tobias Reeder, and he took himself out of position, and it resulted in a 2-on-1. I realize that's bad.
Yeah.
And I've watched Nick Lidstrom, who never threw a body check in his life, and he is maybe the best defenseman that I've ever seen live. So yeah. I want to know where the value is in a body check right now in terms of the way analytics view the game.
I think the, you know, like you said off the top, the first thing that people say is, you know, if you're giving hits, it means you don't have the puck. And so I think the concern is if you're somebody who accumulates a ton of hits. And Weber, I mean, he has a lot of hits, but he doesn't have this outrageous, you know, Matt Martin, Cal Clutterbuck kind of hit count. And so I don't get terribly worried about that. I think in the grand scheme of it, you want guys who hit, but you need you know, that's sort of an input that gets you, you know, the end result. You want guys who hit because it breaks up the play and turns over the puck and things like that. You know, you don't necessarily need somebody who's running around all over the ice recording hit after hit after hit. You just need somebody who can hit and hit effectively. And look, Weber has the size and strength to be an effective physical player, obviously. But, you know, the challenge is for any defenseman who relies on that physical play is it going to take you out of position, you know, as you go try and, you know, bury somebody through the boards? And B, how is it going to age you? Because that's one of the things that, you know, we find is that the defensemen who have tended to age well aren't the most physical guys. They're guys who move the puck and skate and don't tend to be out there laying their body on the line every night because, you know, you start doing that for 10 or 15 years and it catches up to you. And so at what point is Shea Weber, you know, going to start, you know, seeing more decline or just start getting hurt because of how much, you know, wear he puts on his body?
Finishing up with Scott Cullen of TSN, TSN.ca, statistically speaking, every day on Melnick in the afternoon on TSN 690. So the final question is, what is happening with his old team in terms of possession? What I know, again, it's right out of the gate here. We haven't even played 10 games, but what's going on in Nashville?
That's a good question. And I don't know that we have a definitive answer. I know that they've shuffled up the defense pairings, that, you know, Subban and Josi were split up the other day. And, you know, and I wonder whether that is enough to, you know, you just need stylistic change, you know, that maybe Subban and Josi are two really good puck movers and you maybe need somebody to play a little safer alongside them. Or you know, like I haven't dug into it deep enough to see what the you know, the overall problems are in Nashville, but it's kind of stunning to see them struggling possession wise so early, because, you know, under Peter Laviolette they've been a pretty strong possession team. You know, they tend to play an attacking style, and that, you know, if you have enough skill, and it appears that the Predators do, you know, then it should be okay. Now, I mean, maybe the numbers are also skewed because they had a couple of games where food poisoning, you know, kind of ran through their lineup. Like they had a game the other night where they had their fourth line was all three of them were call-ups from the AHL and they got destroyed, like something like 0 shots for and 12 against, with that fourth line on the ice. So, you know, that may have some small factor in this, but I think, you know, if this continues that way, I'll have to start digging deeper to find out why Nashville, a team that seems to have all kinds of skill and should be able to move the puck, is somehow getting outshot.
Scott Cullen of TSN, always a treat. Thanks so much for jumping on with us again today.
Anytime. Thanks a lot, guys.
Appreciate it.